Well, good morning again. We are going to be continuing on. I had the Sunday off last Sunday, missed you all tremendously, but did get some time to unplug. But we will be continuing on with our series on Nehemiah. One of the things that's really interesting to me about Nehemiah is how much Nehemiah speaks to the world that we're in now. We're starting back up again. For the second semester that I'm in seminary, and the class I'm taking this time is an Old Testament survey class. And there's a discussion board. And on the discussion board, I mentioned that we were going through a series on Nehemiah, and it was really interesting to see these people talking about from churches all over the country, and in some senses all over the world, talking about, well, you know, we're going through a series on Nehemiah. I just felt like the Lord was leading us to go through a series on Nehemiah. And I think it's because Nehemiah is a book and is a message that is very appropriate for this time. Because what you see Nehemiah going through is exactly what is being faced by many leaders or people of influence in our world today. Are they going to succumb to culture? Are they going to kind of give in to everything that's going on? And the question is, how are we going to respond? What are we going to do? So let's pray together. Lord, I just thank you for today. I thank you for our church family. I thank you for your word. I thank you for the message that you have for us today in the book of Nehemiah. And Lord, I'm asking you, Lord, to help me to stay out of your way and to deliver the message that you have for us, to be true to that message and faithful to that message that you have for us. And I just pray these things in your name, Lord Jesus. Amen. I've entitled the message today, Nobody's Fool. I almost entitled it, Ain't Nobody's Fool. Because that's really how I would say it. And that may be how it shows up on YouTube. I don't know. But Ain't Nobody's Fool. And Nehemiah ain't nobody's fool. So let's look at our text for today, which is Nehemiah chapter 6, verses 1 through 14. Now when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arab and the rest of our enemies heard that I had built the wall and that there was no breach left in it, although up to that time I had not set up the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent to me, saying, Come and let us meet together at Hakkaparim in the plain of Ono. But they intended to do me harm. And I sent messengers to them, saying, I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? And they sent to me four times in this way, and I answered them in the same manner. In the same way, Sanballat, for the fifth time, sent his servant to me with an open letter in his hand. That term, open letter, is going to play some significance. Because in this day and this in time that we're talking about, when a letter is referred to as an open letter, it meant it was okay for everybody carrying that letter from Samaria to Jerusalem to open it up and read it. There's a point to that. There's a point for Sanballat doing it that way. He wants the gossip to start. In it is written, it is reported among the nations, and Geshem also says it, that you and the Jews intend to rebel. That is why you are building the wall. And according to these reports, you wish to become their king. And you have also set up prophets to proclaim concerning you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. And now the king will hear of these reports. So now come and let us take counsel together. Then I sent to him saying, No such things as you say have been done. For you are inventing them out of your own mind. For they all wanted to frighten us, thinking their hands will drop from the work and it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands. What does Nehemiah do? He prays. Now, when I went into the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, son of Methabel, who was confined in his home, he said, Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. They are coming to kill you by night. But I said, Should such a man as I run away, and what place, and what man such as I could go into the temple and live? Again, an important thing that we'll be touching on a little bit later. Because the language used here is this supposed prophet wants Nehemiah to come into the inner courts of the temple. Nehemiah is a layman. And what Nehemiah is saying there is, I'm not a person who can go there. And that will prove important in our understanding. I will not go in. And I understood and saw that God had not sent him, but he had pronounced the prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this purpose he was hired, that I should be afraid and act in this way and sin. And so they could give me a bad name in order to taunt me. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, O my God, according to these things that they did, and also the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who wanted to make me afraid. In the last two chapters of the book of Nehemiah, we have seen three forms of opposition, each one a threat to Nehemiah's plans to rebuild the wall around the city of Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem itself for all intents and purposes, and the people of Jerusalem. The first two forms of opposition were external. They came from the outside. The first was opposition by ridicule, which, as I've described it, is the darling of the enemy's nursery. This is the way you start to get at people. You ridicule them. You mock them. You try to make them feel shame, and as a result of that shame, they retreat. The second form is opposition by threat of violence or force. Fear, in other words. Nehemiah defeated opposition with faith in God, incredible courage, and pragmatic wisdom. He knows what to do. He knows how to do it because he knows where to turn to get the wisdom, skill necessary to defeat this attack. The third form of opposition was internal. It came as a result of greed and pride and led to the oppression of the poor by the wealthy and elite in Israel. It was one Jew oppressing another, and it threatened to tear the fabric of a nation literally apart. These are people that could not understand how their Jewish brothers were oppressing them. After all, aren't we all Jews? Aren't we all serving God? Isn't that the way it should go? And yet you're oppressing me. Nehemiah overcame this form of opposition by basically following God's plan for conflict resolution that Jesus outlined in Matthew 18, verses 15 through 17. He confronted the oppressors privately and then took it public when they refused to listen and comply. Once Nehemiah had the internal problem behind him, he went back to the work on the wall, and he worked fast. In short order, the entire wall was built to the desired height. Only the gates remained to be completed. But opposition never dies easily, particularly when so much is at stake. And Nehemiah's enemies are not ready to run up the white flag yet. He is still under their skin. In this chapter, we will see the final phase to the opposition unfold. They will come at Nehemiah, and they will come at Nehemiah personally. And up to this point, we haven't really seen that. It's been more kind of a big picture, 30,000 foot, this is how we're coming at you as a people. Now, the opposition is going to be aimed at Nehemiah very directly and very personally, and it will be in three forms: deceit, innuendo, and subterfuge. Cyril Barber wrote, "When Sanballat and his co-conspirators realize that they have been outmaneuvered, outgeneraled, and outwitted by Nehemiah, they decide to attack him personally. Their wounded pride will not be appeased until Nehemiah has been humiliated." It's an age-old strategy. Attack the leader, and if he falls, the rest will fall right along with him. But attacking the leader is rarely, if ever, successful if it happens right from jump. And we didn't see it happen right from the beginning in this instance. If the leader is a good leader and an effective leader, at least at the outset, what you're attacking is the strongest link in the chain. If this guy is all he's cracked up to be, if we come at him directly and personally first, we are attacking the strength, not a weak point. And that's why the enemy will often open with the easy stuff, ridicule and threats. And it is It is that point that a move against the leader can be effective, because what happens after ridicule and threats, and what happens naturally in a situation like this, is over time the leader gets worn down. The leader gets tired. The leader gets weary. And that's when an attack directly against the leader can prove effective, when they are weak and they're worn down. I mean, one of the things about the church and about life and about faith right now, there's a lot of people out there that, courtesy of COVID, are tired, that are worn down. I've talked with some young pastors who I deeply like, and one of the things that they have said is, we've been running on adrenaline for 18 months, and our adrenals are exhausted. The answer is, okay, it's time to unplug, do some self-care, and realize that you're at a weak point, and this is when the enemy will attack you. And he will use any number of vehicles to do it, to tear apart the fabric of the church writ large and individual churches. And that's what we have to be ready for. The timeless and the weak don't like the strong. And they will go to great lengths, including manipulation, to try to get their way. And every time it is an attack from the enemy. Look, these guys, Sambalot and Tobiah, that are coming against Nehemiah, don't like the fact that Nehemiah has favor with the king. They don't like the fact that Artaxerxes likes him. They don't like the fact that Artaxerxes is giving them the supplies to rebuild the wall. And what they're focused on is Nehemiah's, Artaxerxes' favorite. Nehemiah's getting all kinds of favor. They forget the fact that Nehemiah was a slave, that Nehemiah worked his way up through the ranks, that Nehemiah was a good and faithful servant to Artaxerxes and earned his respect and earned his trust, and that's why he has the favor. It's not some arbitrary grant. It was work. It was effort. It was faithfulness. It was looking to God. It was praying at every single point along the journey. That's why Nehemiah is who Nehemiah is. But Nehemiah did not succumb to these new forms of attack. He won't back down. And when we see how he did it, we will see additional leadership qualities in Nehemiah. So let's look at the first four verses and what we'll be looking at in terms of opposition by deceit. Now, when Sambalot and Tobiah and Geshem the Arab and the rest of our enemies heard that I had built the wall and that there was no breach left in it, although up to that time I had not set the doors and the gates, Sambalot and Geshem sent to me saying, "Come, let us meet together at Hakkaphirim in the plain of Ono." But they intended to do me harm. And I sent messengers to them saying, "I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you?" And they sent to me four times in this way, and I answered them in the same manner. Now, it sounds a little bit like Nehemiah's kind of arrogant there. I'm doing this great work. Why should I stop? But what Nehemiah is doing is responding very carefully to a situation. Each of the three forms of external opposition that we will be talking today are marked by one thing. They're very subtle. In other words, they are not what they initially appear to be. It's particularly true with this first deceitful approach. The offer of a meeting was subtle and therefore, based on its subtlety, was dangerous. If they had offered a meeting earlier, there is no way that Nehemiah would even consider it. He would not have stopped the work. But now the wall is pretty much done. The only thing left to do is to set the gates in place. They're done. Almost. It almost seems that what's going on here is a political concession. Look, Nehemiah, we all know we opposed him. Rebuilding the wall didn't benefit us. In fact, it hurt us. We all know that you overcame our opposition, so there is no purpose in us continuing to oppose you. We may not like it, but you are the governor of Jerusalem. We are the governors of other provinces. We need to get along. So let's be pals. Let's get together for a group hug and iron things out. How about we meet on the plain of Ono? And what you might think is, what's the problem with a little to get together to discuss things now that the job is done? But the job isn't done. And Nehemiah knows that full well. And it's when the job is almost done that the greatest danger lurks. I mean, Jim will tell you that when you're climbing a mountain, the statistics are very clear. The most dangerous time in any climb is on the way down. It's because everybody's done. The heavy lifting's over. We can put it on cruise. We don't need to worry. Slip and fall. Down you go. It's when you think the job is done or nearly done that the greatest danger lurks. Nehemiah knows that while the gates remain, it's the gates. And without the gates in place, everything's at risk. You can build the greatest wall. You can build the greatest church building. You can build the greatest program. You can have the greatest youth group. You can have all of that. But if you don't have the defenses in place, if your gates aren't in place, doesn't matter how strong and big and tough the walls are, the enemy can just pour right in through the open gates. Nehemiah gets it. He knows where these guys are coming from. He's hip to their tricks. Everything is at risk, and he knows it has to be completed. And look, I'm going to tell you something, and it's something for us and for the church as a whole. We need to be in prayer. We need to be in prayer. Look, God has things for us to do. And I think we're doing at least some of them. And that is the time. Do you think the enemy's happy that a little church in Tacoma is doing the things that we want to do? Do you think that he wants us to reach this community? Do you think he wants kids saved at PBS? Do you think he wants any of that to happen? Because if you do, you're wrong. Do you think he sees it as, well, it's a small church, so it's not a threat? No. There will be opposition that comes in any time God's people are on the move for God's purposes. And it will generally come in a form of somebody or something trying to create division and opposition within the ranks. So be ready. Be ready in your organization. Be ready in your church. Be ready in your home. If you think that the devil likes a strong marriage, guess again. The enemy wants nothing more than to break up the strong marriages. Do you think that the enemy wants the world out there to see? Do you think the enemy wanted the world to see the memorial service yesterday where a family talked about the impact of the patriarch of that family on every family member and on the people in the community? Do you think the enemy wants the world to see a man of color come up here and talk about how a white man walked with him through a difficult time in his life in a period of time where that might not have been the most popular thing to do? That testimony to the world about how people can get along and people can do things together and people can reach out a hand and help someone through a difficult time. Do you think that's the kind of testimony that the enemy wants the world to see? No. The enemy wants the world to see exactly for the most part, they're seeing right now. People in the church fight with each other, call each other names, tear each other apart over silly stuff. That's what the enemy wants. See, that's the picture of the church that the enemy wants the world to see. And we have to be ready. We have to be in prayer. It's those times when we think we're headed in the right direction that we are making progress, that the enemy is going to make his move. It may seem just like a distraction or an annoyance. It may seem like static on the radio. Oh, here we go again. But it is an attack from only one source. And the goal of that attack, it doesn't even matter if the person who is facilitating the attack even knows that it's going on. Look, the enemy is a deceiver. And he deceives even the people he uses to split people apart. It's an attack, and we have to be in prayer. Nehemiah knows what the basis of all this discussion is. It's an attack. It's let your guard down, Nehemiah. You've done all this great work for God. You've built this wall. It's high. It's strong. Only the gates remain. Take a breath. Go meet with the boys out on the plains of Ono. Work to get along. Don't sound arrogant and say you've got a big project and isn't it great. Work to get along. Drop what you're doing. We see Nehemiah's incredibly focused response in verse 3. And I sent messengers to them saying, I am doing a great work and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? And in verse 4, Nehemiah tells us that Sanballat and Geshem sent the same message four times. I mean, this is like the child in the grocery store aisle. I want the chocolate cocoa puffs. No. 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 Until after about the fifth, all right, get the dang chocolate cocoa puffs and put them in the cart. Let's go. You know, that's the goal here with these guys. But every time he says the same thing. Nope. Now, a couple of things about leadership to notice here. A couple of things about Nehemiah's leadership to notice here. A leader has to be able to say no. And a whole bunch of people can't do that because they're far too concerned about how people will see them. Look, it's necessary sometimes to tell one person or groups of people no. And it may be for a little reason or it may be for a big reason. We've had groups of people that are well-meaning that want to use this building, for example. And we have to tell them no. We don't want, it's in Middle Eastern terminology, camel's nose coming into the tent. I mean, it's just that simple. You know, when a secret society isn't going to meet here at Hope Church. You know, I mean, those are the kinds of things. We can't let that into the building. This is God's house. He intends it to be used his way. That it just it is. But leaders and groups of leaders have to be able to say no, regardless of how people may think about the answer no. And you may well have to keep saying no, because their request will be repeated, whether it's a child repeating what they want over and over, or somebody within an organization, or an enemy is hoping you will wear down, wear out, and relent. You may face the tough situation of saying to a good friend, no, in order to continuing following God's plan. And to do otherwise is simply compromise. Look, there's people I don't want to say no to. I can tell you there's a lot of people I don't want to say no to. There's a lot of people that would be far easier to just say yes to. I like them. I don't want to hurt their feelings. But sometimes you have to tell them no. And sometimes that's what's necessary to be pursuing God's plan. Nehemiah knows these guys are up to no good. They mean to harm him. He says so in verse 2, but he uses that understanding and wisdom to his advantage. He doesn't antagonize them, thereby putting them on alert. He just keeps saying no. He's not picking a fight with them. He's not trying to pull the sheets off everything. He's just saying flat out, no, I'm not going to do it. I mean, it's hard for them to argue with what amounts to, look, I'm too busy to meet with you boys. I'm working on this project. You've come against me every way you possibly can on this project. You know it's a labor. You know it's a labor of love for me. It's a big project. And maybe we can talk when we're done. But right now, I'm finishing this up. I don't have time to meet with you. Nehemiah displays an uncanny ability to see all of the issues involved very clearly and to stand firm under the pressure being leveled against him. And that ability protects him and protects the project and protects the city. And then in verses 5 through 7. In the same way, Sanballat, for the fifth time, sent his servant to me with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, it is reported among the nations, and Geshem also says it, that you and the Jews intend to rebel. That is why you are building the wall. And according to these reports, you wish to become their king. And you have also set up prophets to proclaim concerning you in Jerusalem, there is a king in Judah. And now the king will hear of these reports. So now, come and let us take counsel together. I mean, do you see what's going on there? There's all these things that people are saying about you, Nehemiah, and all I want to do is just clear the air. I just want to make sure the king really understands what you are really all about. I mean, these people are saying that you're rebelling, that you're building the wall because you want to set up your own kingdom. You want to be Big Bank Hank. You want to be the big holler, big baller in the holler. You want to be all of these wonderful things. And I don't want Artaxerxes to come away with that. I mean, please. They are playing what they think is hardball. It's innuendo. It's really a rehash of the same charge they made in chapter 2, verse 19. What is this thing you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? You got to remember, when we started this series, we looked back at a letter that was sent to Artaxerxes by these guys. Their whole point was the only reason they want to do anything in Jerusalem is because they want to create their own thing. They're rebelling against you, which is going to take away tax revenue and everything else. And the first time they did it, it worked. The king stopped the work on the wall and on the city. So here we go again. But wait, what makes this approach both different and deceitfully dirty is the form in which it was transmitted. We talked about this at the outset. In verse 5, Sanballat now sends a fifth request with his servant, an open letter in his hand. This accusation that is being made is sent in a letter that is open, meaning multiple people will read it as it makes its way from Samaria to Jerusalem. And the message in the letter will be repeated. In other words, it will be gossiped about. And just like any gossip, the point is to cause damage via innuendo that can't be undone. I mean, the most damaging thing about gossip is the message of the gossip, even if we've all seen it happen. Somebody gossips about somebody, and then subsequently it's proven that what that person said was an absolute bold-faced lie. It's like an article appearing in the newspaper, and a month later it's retracted. You can't unring the bell. You can't undo the damage. I mean, there's an old phrase in trial practice in the legal business. You can't unring the bell. It's talking about somebody saying something inappropriate in front of a jury. You can't take, it doesn't matter how many times the judge says, disregard what so-and-so just said. That only cements it. That's like somebody saying, whatever you do, don't think about zebras. Okay, we're all thinking about zebras right now, or at least some of us are. I am. But you can't undo it. You can't unring the bell. And once you get gossip rolling, the damage remains, even if it's proven to be false. And that's the point of gossip. Innuendo can be very difficult to disprove because in many ways it's just gossamer. It's just vapor. And when Sanballat says in verse 7, and now the king will hear of these reports, he is not offering to help out, and as his trite message would seem to indicate. What he is doing is he's threatening to report Nehemiah to Artaxerxes, unless Nehemiah is willing to cooperate with him and meet and cede authority to him. So how does Nehemiah respond? Well, he responds with strength of character and with decisiveness. There is only one way to deal with false rumor and innuendo. Deal with it and deny it immediately. Time to knock it off. People won't like it when you stand up to or confront them. Sanballat doesn't like it when Nehemiah is standing up to him and confronting him, particularly when they have been able to pull their mess for a long period of time. I've been in the position, as many as you have been. You have to confront a situation that nobody wants to confront, that nobody wants to deal with. It's hard. It's tough. Nehemiah is confronting this situation head on. It's mess, okay? It's mess. It's not going to continue on. You need to stop it. I'm not succumbing to it. So sad, too bad. And a lot handling in that way. And what that kind of opposition really gets you more than anything else is a temper tantrum. There'll be an effort to use rumor. That's what Sambalot and these guys are doing. Gossip or innuendo. But you have to be willing to call it out for what it is. But Nehemiah did something else as well here. Something he always does. We see it in verse 9. But now, O God, strengthen my hands. Nehemiah knows, look, he not arrogantly, but he knows he's gifted. He knows that he has these skills, but he knows where they come from. He knows it's not him personally. He knows it's God who's gifted him in this way. That's the fruit of who he is because of God. So he does what he always does. He says, God, strengthen my hands. Help me to respond to this the way you want me to respond to it, God, not the way I might want to respond to it. We've seen, look, and we'll see it again at the end of this of our text for today. We've seen the, hey, Sambalot, talk to the hand, pal. I don't want to hear your mess anymore. God, I'm talking. He's not talking to Sambalot. He's talking to God about Sambalot. He may be saying, get him. He may be wanting lightning bolts to fall. He may want some festering boils for Sambalot. But he knows who's in charge, and he knows where he has to turn. Nehemiah has an inner strength that all of us need to emulate. He has done everything he can. Yes, he has. But he knows whose fight it ultimately is. It's God's. And it is from God that Nehemiah gets that inner strength. And it should be the source of our strength as well. We are not good enough, smart enough, and people like us. That's not where it works. That's not how it works. It's God that gives us the strength we need. And then we see the third and final form, verses 10 through 14, opposition through subterfuge. Now when I went into the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, and the son of Methabel, who was confined to his home, he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. They are coming to kill you by night. But I said, should such a man as I run away? And what man such as I could go into the temple and live? I will not go in. And I understood and saw that God had not sent him, but he had pronounced the prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sambalot had hired him. For this purpose he was hired, that I should be afraid and act in this way and sin. And so they could give me a bad name in order to taunt me. Remember Tobiah and Sambalot, oh my God, according to these things that they did. And also the prophetess, Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets who wanted to make me afraid. The final form of opposition, and it arrives, interestingly enough, in the form of a man who claims to be a man of God. Shemaiah is considered to be a prophet by the locals, and he is confined home, although we are not told why he's confined to his home. I will suggest to you that while it could have been because of illness or part of some vow, I think it's part of a game this guy's playing. I think he wants to create the illusion that this is really, really dangerous. And everybody's out to get us, Nehemiah. We're men of God and people are out to get us. And so I'm confined in my house because I can't dare go out. He stays locked away because he wants the world around him to think he's deathly afraid. And the reason he's deathly afraid, at least the impression he wants to create, is because he's a man of God. But regardless of the reason that he's housebound, the real reason is to try to trick Nehemiah and to discredit him. Nehemiah accepts the invitation to go to his home, and immediately this prophet goes to work. One of the problems with our English translations of Scripture is that we can miss some meaning, subtle and otherwise, because of the problems in translation. Things don't go across smoothly or precisely. And this is one of those places. Because in Hebrew, there's a couple of things going on here. First off, this warning is really in the form of what's called an oracle. That's how this prophet is putting it. He's basically phrasing it as if it's an oracle. In other words, it's a direct message from God. God's words are coming out my mouth. This is not some scared rabbit human talking to you, boy. This is God talking to you. So don't worry about me or the impression you may have of me. This is God talking to you. It's a direct revelation of God from me to you. Shemaiah is trying to tempt Nehemiah to do two things here as part of his plan. First, he wants Nehemiah to put himself and his safety and well-being ahead of the work God had given him. He wants him to stop doing what he's doing because of personal concerns over his safety. He wants Nehemiah to be afraid and to let that fear control him. Second, he wants him to break God's law in order to save his life. This is what I was talking about earlier when you, and it's one of the problems in translation, because when you get what we're going to talk about here, the rest of the text kind of flows, and you understand why it's so important and really what's going on here. When Shemaiah suggests that he and Nehemiah flee to the temple for safety, the term he is using means the holy place. He's not referring to just the temple itself. He's not saying, let's just go inside the front gate, slam it shut, and then we'll be safe. He's saying, let's go into the holy place. Let's go into the very center, the inner courts of the temple, the holiest of places. It's a pagan belief, not a Jewish one, that a person could be spared punishment of a crime by running to one of the nearby pagan temples. Shemaiah is really speaking as a pagan here, which is the beginning of the pulling off of the sheets. He is also suggesting something that is direct violation of Old Testament law, and Nehemiah knows it. Nehemiah is a layman, and laymen were specifically not allowed into the inner portions of the temple. We see that in Numbers 18:7. And now, because of this, Nehemiah knows this man has not been sent by God. This is because Nehemiah is a man of faith, because Nehemiah is a man of prayer, because Nehemiah's life is focused on God. He sees this for what it is. We are talking about God's law here, and God, and Nehemiah knows, and we should know, God is always consistent. God would not send a man to Nehemiah to lead him to sin by breaking the law. God would not send a prophet to Nehemiah to say, I want you to break God's law in order to save your life, and that's a holy thing. God doesn't need for Nehemiah to run into the inner courts of the temple to protect him. God can protect him wherever he is, in whatever way God chooses to protect him. So what Nehemiah sees this prophet is doing is enticing him to abandon his mission, the project that God has given to him, and then to go one step further and to run in that fear into a place that would lead to a violation of God's law by going there. God is always consistent. Nehemiah knows that. And as a result, he knows that this man is a fraud. We would like to think that we can do as we please, sin willfully, and then God will somehow look the other way and change the rules for us. Think of how much trouble we could avoid if we just didn't go there. Cyril Barber wrote, Nehemiah triumphed not by breaking. Characteristics possessed by Nehemiah that both define his incredible success as a leader. First and foremost, let's get to the most important one. Nehemiah is a man of prayer. He is a man who desires to be close to God in everything he does. He prays about everything all of the time. When Nehemiah faces hardship or opposition or oppression, he does not whine or complain. He prays. And then he soldiers on with the work that God has for him to do. Nehemiah sees everything that happens to him or through him in one way that's critically important. Nehemiah sees everything through a spiritual lens. He sees everything in his life through how God would have him respond to it. And he's not afraid to reach out to God at any moment, including in the middle of a conversation, and say, what do I say now? I mean, let's not forget the conversation with Artaxerxes. During the conversation, okay, I don't know how this is going to go. Tell me what to say. And that's how he deals with things. He's not afraid to look to God for wisdom, for guidance, for direction, for strength. Second, Nehemiah is a man with a very clear sense of calling and purpose, and he does not let anything get in the way of that. He knows what he knows, and he knows what God has for him and what God has for him to do, and he's not going to shirk that. Third, Nehemiah is very aware of who he is and how he's gifted. This isn't arrogance, and it's easy to see it that way. It's easy to see someone who understands their gifting and their calling. It's easy to look at them and see them as arrogant. It isn't arrogance, it's self-awareness. Now, I'm not saying that people who don't, well, I'm gifted in this way, and I'm called to do this, and isn't that spectacular? Yeah, you can certainly be arrogant. But when you look at a guy like Nehemiah, who knows what his gifting is and is laser focused on it, that's not arrogance, that's self-awareness. And Nehemiah knows that any gifting that he has is from God. And he would not have that gifting in the first place if it had come from God. Nehemiah is faced with an incredible task, but he is not intimidated by that task because he knows that God and God alone has given him the skill set necessary for the task. Nehemiah knows that he will not be defeated because God is on his side. And fourth, Nehemiah is a man of incredible wisdom and discernment. And again, he knows where that wisdom and discernment comes from. Nehemiah sees what's going on as a chess game. Move, counter move. He's constantly asking God for wisdom in this process until they get to the point of checkmate. And he knows who got him to the point of checkmate. God. Nehemiah knows every move is in him going to try to make, and he is able to counter them at every turn, and he does not let his frustration or anger control him. He knows what that will lead to. Look, we've seen flashes of Nehemiah's frustration. I mean, the talk to the hand thing, and we're going to see it, verse 14 here. It's like, you know, just remember them, okay? Okay, God, let's remember these dudes. Let's remember who they are and what they did. Could you do that for me, please? I mean, if you don't think that's a flash of frustration, guess again. This is a guy basically saying, look, these guys are doing me dirty, and I hope you remember it. I'm going to be good. I'm going to keep my eyes focused on you. I hope you remember the mess they pulled. And fifth, Nehemiah is a man of tremendous courage, and we can't forget or minimize this one. Look, we have many examples throughout history of incredibly gifted people who failed miserably in tough times because they lacked courage. I've seen plenty of them in my life, people who are incredibly gifted, and gifted communicators, gifted administrators, gifted in whatever way they might be gifted. But they don't have the courage to carry it through because they want to please people or they want to line their own pockets or whatever it might be. Nehemiah is not that guy. Nehemiah has courage. And we need to remember something important. Courage is not about a lack of fear, because there will be times when we are literally gripped with fear. What courage is about doing what God has called us to do, even when we are afraid, when we're anxious, or when we're offended. We can be gripped with fear and still have courage if we know that our God reigns. Verse 14 does provide an interesting conclusion. Remember Tobiah and Sambalat, oh my God, according to these things that they did. Also the Noadiah and the rest of prophets to make me afraid. Look, Nehemiah is a man. He has emotions like a man. He has feelings like a man. He has frustrations like a man. He knows who's in charge. And you might take this as weakness or a parting shot or succumbing to it. I don't see it as any of those ways. I just see it is, I see in some ways, not any direct revelation, I'm not attempting to add to Scripture, but I can just see God saying, look, Nehemiah, I know. I know who they are. I know what they've done. You just do what I have for you to do, and you let me worry about them. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Understand that, Nehemiah. Your feelings about them get in the way of you doing what I have for you to do. You worry about what I gave you to do. You let me worry about them. I understand. I mean, I've had many conversations with Rachel. It's just not fair. And by the way, if you ever want to respond to your child saying it's not fair, please don't do what I've done many times and say, well, honey, the world's just not a fair place. It doesn't work well. You kind of have to go through the process of saying, I understand. I understand why you feel that way. I validate what you're saying. But why don't you focus on what God has for you to do in this moment and not worry about these other people? Not worry about them getting theirs. Not worry about fairness for them. Worry about faithfulness for you. Look, as we're talking about many different things, and the things I'm talking about us doing in this church, it's like discipleship. It's hard to really kind of wrap your head in some senses around discipleship and what it means. Many people look at salvation, the walk of faith, is simply kind of raising your hand, signing the card, saying the prayer, singing the song, and I'm done, we're through, off we go. If you're involved in discipleship, either personally or with somebody else, that's more kind of like extra credit work. You know, I'm kind of going above and beyond. As opposed to seeing it as part of our faith journey, part of who we are as believers in Christ, part of wanting to be equipped to be disciples ourselves and to disciple others. To taking a step out, to talking about the gospel with people. Are we willing to do what the Lord has for us to do in every way and focus on just that? It's hard. It was hard for Nehemiah, and it will be hard for us. But are we willing to do it? Because I think that's what God has for us to do. Look, I'm a hothead. I'll go off like that. I'll act a fool as easy as anybody else. No question about it. Raise my hand, I'm guilty. Okay? But am I willing to put that aside, as hard as it might be? Look, I'm the king of these kind of snippy comments. Yeah, I understand what you have for me to do, and I sure hope you think about Joe Schmo over there, who really is doing some stupid stuff. And just like with Nehemiah, just like with me, just like with us, I think what God is saying is, look, you do what I have for you to do, and you let me worry about Joe Schmo, you let me worry about this person, you let me worry about this person, you just be faithful and focus on me and give your life to me, surrender your life to me, surrender your will to me, and let's do this. So let's do this. Let's surrender. There's going to be a song. I rarely look at the songs. We're going to have conclude our worship with a song about taking it to the cross, taking it to the altar. Think about that today. What do we need to take to the altar and take it there? Lord, I just thank you for today. I thank you for the many blessings that you've bestowed upon us. Help us to be all about the things that you have us to be about. Help us to be about you. Help us to be about the mission, the plan, the purpose that you have for us, and to not be concerned about what others may be doing or how they may be doing it. Let us be your people, following your plan and your purpose for our lives. And if there's anything we need to take to the cross, to lay at the altar, help us to do it today. And I just pray these things in your name, Lord Jesus. Amen.